Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Labor strikes, huge surprises, and big misses. The Hollywood summer of 2023 is one we will not soon forget, and there's a lot to unpack here. I'm so pleased to have with me Ryan Fonder, who covers the business of Hollywood for the LA Times and is the author of the industry newsletter, The Wide Shot. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. So cool to be here.
What a summer. I want to start talking about some box office. Of course, Sunday, we had the big news that Barbie reached $1 billion globally at the box office. Gerwig makes history. Talk about the significance for the industry right now.
Well, it's just massive. I mean, the industry really needed a boost of confidence after a summer that you've seen just a number of movies that were good. I mean, like well-known franchises, pretty safe bets from the studios usually, that just didn't pan out quite the way, like even Mission Impossible with a Rotten Tomatoes score that was in the 90s. Came in a little under expectations in terms of its opening weekend and hasn't held on as much as people like. So you started to see the questions again, like, are people going to the movies? Are we ever getting back to the kind of pre, you know, 2020 level of box office and volume and revenue and all that? But this just really lit a fire. And it was, I don't know if you talked about this on the show before, but just the invigorating spectacle of people, groups of friends dressed in pink, going to the movie theaters. Some people, you know, decked out for Oppenheimer, but you know, it was, I don't know, going to see it at the Grove opening weekend in LA is really just a party atmosphere. It was like every restaurant's packed. Everyone's getting drinks beforehand. Everyone's staying after to hang out in the mall to talk about the movie. It was like, you know, it was like going to the movies in the 90s again.
And this is certainly an event. Do you think we'll be seeing more of this type of thing, or is this just a one-off?
I mean, the more obvious takeaway is that it looks like Mattel is going to be cranking out toy brand movies until the end of time, or until something stops work, doesn't work, and you know, the Hot Wheels movie fails, or the Uno movie can't get off the ground, and they have to change strategies. But that may be the wrong lesson from this, because there is something very unique about the Barbie phenomenon, and just the fact that it was Greta Gerwig. She had such a strong point of view. She's making it. She had two stars in lead roles that like couldn't have been more perfectly cast, and had a take and was able to bring it to life in this way that I don't think anyone who saw rumors of a Barbie movie 5 years ago would have anticipated.
And the fact that Greta Gerwig made history as the first solo directed movie by a woman to reach these box office numbers, and it's one of 53 movies, right, that have reached $1 billion. What does this mean for going forward?
It's great. I mean, Hollywood's always kind of looking at the latest example of something that worked and saying, okay, this is the breakthrough moment. This is the breakthrough moment. But you know, as I'm sure you've pointed out and your listeners know, I mean, it's difficult for it's still difficult for female directors to get started even after they've had a successful film. Gerwig's obviously in a different category, because she's already had, you know, a number of Oscar-nominated movies, and it's extremely successful. But you know, it's always okay, what's the next thing, and is this going to translate into studios giving female directors more of a chance? You know, that might require a little bit of more change of mentality. That's a little bit deeper than just looking at one box office number. But you know, we can hope. Every billion dollar blockbuster certainly counts or something.
You mentioned Mission Impossible. Were you surprised considering the Maverick success that Tom Cruise had last year?
I was. I thought there might have been kind of a Top Gun Maverick glow or halo after that movie was so successful and everyone, including Marty Scorsese, crowned Tom Cruise the savior of cinema. But it's as we've seen time and time again, it's not just the movie star, it's the role, it's the franchise. It's you have to see it now in a theater sort of atmosphere that gets people to go, especially opening weekend.
In terms of superhero movies, although there are certain films that did go well this year, say Guardians, for example, many really didn't live up to expectations, like Flash, and these are movies both from DC and Marvel. Is there a superhero fatigue?
I wrote a little bit about this a while ago when James Gunn and Peter Safran, the co-heads of DC Studios, unveiled their big slate for 8 to 10 year plan for DC Studios, and you know, Flash and Blue Beetle are holdovers from a prior regime, so they can't take all the blame for that. But one thing that James Gunn said, which is interesting, and I think he's at least partly right about this, is that superhero fatigue is real, but it's because the movies aren't as good as people are hoping for. It's like superhero fatigue is real, but it's more like bad superhero movie fatigue is real. The quality just hasn't been there for a lot of these films. You know, you look at what was the latest Marvel? Oh, it's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Went
pretty well, and was a James Gunn movie. So, but there was one before that wasn't
as successful. Season.
Okay, but yeah, in DC world, that's a good example too of something that just disappointed. And these critics' reactions and the audience reactions were like, okay, not only we've been here before with so many other movies, but also it wasn't the quality that we were expecting. I really think that quality matters a lot with these movies, and basically every movie. I don't think anything's fully critic proof anymore.
But what is the reason for the decline of quality here? There's great people who want to make these movies. What happened there?
Well, there's a lot of things that are going on. I don't know about lazy. Mm-hmm. There could be some of that, but there's definitely, I mean, you're definitely seeing just so much volume, because there was a period of time when Marvel was not just a movie studio anymore. They were putting out 3 or 4 movies a year with the Avengers and everything like that, and they were also doing the same thing on Disney Plus with the TV shows, and they're cranking out 2 or 3 TV shows a year, and
it just became totally saturated.
There's too much for the audience, and there's too much for the creators too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can't keep up. Just this week, the VFX workers, the visual effects workers at Marvel Studios, said that they had made a significant move to unionize. Like, they're going to hold a union election, and that's a first for the VFX industry. Typically they have not been represented by guilds. Now they're probably going to be joining IATSE. So that's just a signal of like, guys, we need to pump the brakes here a little bit, and maybe put out a few fewer of these things. So we take our time with it. The head of Marvel's VFX division lost her job. You know, a lot of the speculation around that was that it had something to do with some of the complaints about the quality of the VFX
at
Marvel Studios. So But there were a lot of explanations there. That might be a bit of a tangent for this conversation,
but do you, no, no, nothing. Do you think that they will?
There are no tangents here.
No, okay. No tangents. Go ahead. But do you think that they will put some brakes on these type of movies for a while?
It does seem like, I mean, Disney specifically, Bob Iger has said that he recognizes that it's been too much, too fast, and not good enough. That has been the main problem for Hollywood with a lot of these franchises, is that there's been too much stuff and it's not good enough. So that was the problem with a lot of the Star Wars material that didn't do as well as people hoped, and really I think really hurt the brand. I think the big people at the top, you know, they are obsessed with the stock prices, and the stock prices do go up when these movies are greenlit and they come out. Mm-hmm. But it does matter. It does matter what the fans think, not just the crazy fans, but like the real.
Yeah. What about a completely different genre? The sort of what should I call them? The sort of big adult dramas that were so Oscar huge many years ago. Things like Tar and Fablemans, and that category of movies right. seemed to struggle quite a bit last year. We saw. Do you think that that mid-level big movie is going to be difficult going forward?
I don't know, because it's hard to actually pinpoint a lot of examples of those types of movies that have come out in theaters. Like you mentioned Tar. Tar is a very specific kind of film. It's mm-hmm. a 3-hour, basically solo character study about a not very likable person. It's
kind of like Oppenheimer.
Well, it's true. I should retract my statement. Now studios will only make 3-hour character studies of unlikable characters. But yeah, it is just really on a film by film basis. And it did seem like in terms of Oppenheimer, I mean, you just had like the Christopher Nolan effect of it, and they marketed that movie like crazy, and felt like you, especially with the Barbenheimer thing going on, you felt like you had to go. So I don't know, that gives me a little bit of hope. But also the Wes Anderson movie did pretty decent,
right?
You know,
Asteroid
considering
City.
Yeah, Asteroid City, that one did pretty well, and it's not considered, you have these filmmakers that are brands unto themselves that, you know, they're not as well known as the toy Barbie or Marvel as a brand, but they are recognizable names, and people know when they put something out into the world, it's an event, it's something special.
Meanwhile, something that's had huge success is the child trafficking drama Sound of Freedom, which has gone gangbusters at the box office. I haven't talked about this movie much on my show, so what is this and what happened here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a film starring Jim Caviezel from Passion of the Christ, you know, sort of the original faith based mega hit that had this kind of phenomenal groundswell of support from you know, faith based communities and you know, sort of adjacent audiences, whatever that means. The film is about, you know, is about child trafficking. It's kind of become controversial because of past statements that the star has made that are sort of like very QAnon-y, and it's just taken off. It's the company behind it is this firm called Angel Studios, and they have this interesting model where, you know, there's some group buying going on at theaters. There's some, you know, wealthy individuals who will buy out theaters and you know, basically host free screenings. And there's this pay it forward aspect too, where at the end of the film, you see this kind of this image of Jim Caviezel, the star, and telling the people who just watched the movie, thank you so much for coming out to the theaters. You know, this is kind of thing that we see in a lot from movie stars and screenings. This is a little different because he'll come on at the end and say, thank you for coming to the theaters. If you like what you saw and you want to make a difference, you can buy a ticket for a stranger and let them see this for free. And that's apparently been happening quite a lot, and boosting the numbers a bit. So there's a couple things going on. There's clearly a groundswell of grassroots support for this film. And there's also this sort of unique aspect of it that is getting more people in the door. And I think that's something that, you know, for certain movies, Hollywood and other studios could copy, you know, this kind of like, hey, if you like this, get buy a ticket for someone else to see it.
So this could be a model that they're paying attention to, irregardless of the controversy surrounding this movie, so to speak.
I mean, and it's not like the group buying thing is completely original. Even you had group screenings for movies that had all kinds of kind of cause related aspects to it, and you know, Black Panther, like that, a big part of the phenomenon was that there were people who bought out full theaters for folks to go see it because it was such an event. So this kind of thing kind of feeds on itself a little bit. But yeah, I'm sure Hollywood executives are looking at this and saying, how can we do this?
And what about this audience, sir, that is going to this movie? What I imagine is a conservative group, at least the ones that are paying for the screenings and things like that. Is this a group of viewers that the studios will, you know, want access to and want to make more for?
Yeah, I mean, there's been even Top Gun Maverick, I think, like, you know, sort of militaristic gung-ho movie, it cut across political lines in a way that a lot of movies don't necessarily. The thing that I always think about is that Hollywood movies are so apolitical most of the time. Like the blockbusters are so down the middle and trying not to offend anybody that it's really hard to read a lot of political leanings into it at all. And so there is a sense that the kind of Christian conservative audience is underserved. There have been a lot of specifically faith-based movies that have been made, and some studios have been built around that idea of catering to that underserved audience. The quality hasn't always been there on the Hollywood level. That's for sure. But this film in particular has, when it first came out anyway, actually did quite well with critics. It was, you know, competently made. It was interesting story, and you know, it benefited from that. So I still think that Hollywood tends to try to avoid controversy as much as possible.
I just want to get back to what you wrote, that uncertainty is back.
Now that these strikes have gone to, let's see, the WGA strike is getting to day
Since
100,
May. Yeah,
I think this week. And what that means is that, especially with the actor strike now, is that productions aren't being made. The actors can't go out and promote the fall films. And, you know, if this stretches into December, I mean, who knows how that affects Oscar season and everything else. What you're starting to see is studios weigh the costs and benefits of, you know, holding their films in theaters on their release dates in November, October, September, or whether the film is so dependent on star power and so dependent on, you know, having, let's just say, Zendaya or somebody walking the red carpet, that they can't release the movie without having that benefit, without having the star be able to do junkets and things like that. So challenges moved out. The Luca Guadagnino film was supposed to premiere at, I think, Venice. And yeah, as its release date has moved into next year. And Sony put out a release saying that it was pushing Ghostbusters and Kraven the Hunter into 2024 as well. So yeah, that we haven't seen that from other studios, though, in a real way. Sony's been kind of the one that's made those moves. There's been a lot of talk about Dune 2 and what Warner Brothers might do there. It seems like it's from what I hear, they're sticking with their date. Warner Brothers executives that I talked to are adamant that they are sticking with their fall release date for that one. So we'll see, but it'll be an interesting moment. It'll be an interesting thing for me to watch because we'll get to see how important like a star-driven press campaign really is for film and box office and all of that, or whether Hollywood's just been doing this thing with the junkets and the red carpets for so long that it's just habit and we can't get out of it. And I just don't know. But yeah, there's no question that there's films that are moving from fall to next year, and that's going to have an impact on the momentum for theaters right now.
And in terms of the strikes, I've had a few shows about those, but on Friday, the WGA met with the AMPTP for the first time since May. And by all accounts, what I've read, it didn't go too well. Nothing mm-hmm. much seemed to have come out of that. Big question, but what is going to get us out of this, do you think? They seem so far apart. What do you see happening that could sort of move them together, or do you?
Someone has to, I mean, the sides have to compromise. And right now what's difficult is there are two buckets of issues in the strikes. As far as I'm concerned, there's the kind of normal union, just pure money stuff. That's like, okay, we're raising
living wage wages and inflation. And
yeah, exactly. And we're figuring out the, contributions to the healthcare programs and all that kind of stuff. That's totally normal union stuff, that there's always a difference and kind of figure it out. The things that are more difficult are changes that are going to the fundamental problems and changes that have affected the industry in the last couple of years. So the writers' demands to have the minimum staffing requirements, like a certain number of writers per episode required to be staffed on a show in a writer's room, to studios, that is just a non-starter, and they're totally opposed to that. And it's really hard to see how you compromise on the issue without one side just kind of caving and dropping the whole thing. And the other aspect is this issue that is affecting both strikes is the writers and actors demanding basically revenue participation. So they want to be able to participate in the success of a show that does really well on streaming. And there are a number of problems with that. One is like a lot of people even the showrunners in certain instances, like there was a piece on The Ankler where the showrunner from Dickinson on Apple TV Plus, like they don't even know how well their shows are doing.
Yeah, the transparency is zero in most cases.
Yeah, in most cases. I mean, if your show does really well and it ends up on the sort of public reporting that goes up on Netflix, and Netflix wants to brag about how great your show is doing, then great. Then you have some idea of how many people watched your show. But for a lot of these companies, it's very, very, very lacking in terms of data. There's a lot of ideas of how to create sort of a residual program for streaming based on the success of a show, but I don't think there's any, like, it's hard to come up with a one size fits all for that mm-hmm. for that issue. So that's another one where it's like, okay, you're either going to do it or you're not going to do it. Like, what's the deal? And AI is the same thing. It's like trying to get the studios to commit to not using AI. Well, they're already using AI, and other companies are doing the same thing. So you know, it's also hard to see, you know, what those protections look like. And those worries are really understandable because you see how actors are having their likenesses used, and mm-hmm. if that happens without consent or without proper
some sort of regulation
regulation. Yeah, it has to be regulated. So it can be kind of, so from their perspective, it's scary stuff. You have to work it out.
Do you see dragging on. I mean, the studio seemed to, or at least at the beginning, when we were getting these anonymous sources, that they were basically, the studios were basically willing to wait for writers to lose their homes. It sounded like that they could take this for, you know, on for a pretty long time. What do you think? Was that just scare tactics or?
Well, the studios, I actually wrote about this today, which is that there's been this kind of narrative bandied about that the studios are, that these strikes are a gift to these studios because they're saving all this money. Well, they are, and they are saving money. It is going to be significant. And it comes at a time when Wall Street is looking at these studios and demanding more free cash flow, bigger profits. And it comes after a time when studios, frankly, spent too much creating a lot of content for streaming. So it's overinvestment followed by a pullback. That was probably going to happen anyway. The strike is helping with that in a way, in this kind of like taking a sledgehammer to a nail kind of way. But I think the studios would like to be a little bit more strategic in the way that they cut costs, and this the savings that they're having now are going to be super ephemeral. They're going to evaporate as soon as the strike ends, because they're going to ramp up content spending again. And what's going to happen is that there's going to be long-term consequences for a prolonged strike. You know, you're already facing declining TV ratings. The fall TV season's totally wiped out. You're going to see more people cut the cord, cut the cable cord, and give up their satellite subscriptions, because there's not that much to watch on on TV right now. Especially, just look at the broadcast schedule for fall. It's all reality and reruns of Yellowstone on CBS. It's not great. So that's going to be, if it's a gift to anyone, it's a gift to Netflix, because it's just, you know, it's handing customers over to your competition, your legacy studio.
So just ballpark, what do you think? Was it going to go end in September, or are we going to see this all the way through 2023?
Warner Brothers Discovery said its model was September. That seems wildly optimistic at this point, considering they're not even talking, and they can't even have a successful talk about talking.
I'm laughing, but it's so absurd.
It is insane. I keep hearing December is kind of the new guesstimate. Maybe it gets done earlier than that. I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm sure there's some like self-preservation thinking in there. It's just like, let's I'm sure if it goes on till December, then you start eating into fall, like award season and all that stuff, so that would be pretty bad, but for the industry. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm hearing right now.
I have one more thing I want to ask you about regarding what we've been reading about a lot this summer, and that's China. It seems that Chinese audiences are kind of gravitating towards movies that are made at home rather than Hollywood movies, and that this has been a big shift. What is this about, and what is the impact on Hollywood?
Well, this has been happening for quite a long time, and I've written about it a bit. My friend and counterpart of the Wall Street Journal, Eric Schwartzel, has written
a book about it.
And it was quite good.
Red Carpet, I think it's called, right? Red Carpet.
Yeah, Red Carpet. Yeah. And the impact on Hollywood, I mean, that's the easy one. It's like Hollywood spent so much money and greenlit movies with certain budgets a number of years ago, with the assumption or on the bet that they would get that this gangbusters box office explosion from China would continue. And now they're seeing the consequences of when that bet kind of went sideways, because you're right, and the Chinese audiences are not looking to go out to see the latest Mission Impossible or the latest Hollywood thing. They want to see things that are made by studios in China, which totally makes sense.
And that's also because they've been started making more, right? I mean, that they've sort of been saturated with Hollywood movies, and now their own movies are really building up their industry, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's 100% right. I mean, and the irony of it is that Hollywood had a very prominent role in helping to build that industry up. So similar to how it built up Netflix by licensing a bunch of movies to the platform that mm-hmm. ended up becoming their biggest rival. The U.S. studios helped teach Chinese studios how to make movies that would do well on the mainland.
Oh, the irony.
And it's an amazing story. For a while it worked out quite well because the box office was quite good for the U.S. studios in China.
But now will we more and more see studios who maybe are not counting on China to begin with?
They're going to have to. I mean, at this point, it's not worth it for them because they have to go through all the regulatory issues. Mm-hmm. They have to censor the films. Like, if China's going to ask, the Chinese Communist Party is going to ask Sony to basically redo the end of the Spider-Man movie so it doesn't take place on the top of the Statue of Liberty, then that's going to be a little bit too much to ask. And that's the kind of thing that Hollywood's had to worry about trying to get movies into China, is that you spend all this money and you end up not even getting your movie in. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is you get the movie in, but it doesn't do any business. I think Hollywood definitely has to take that into account. There are some there's some examples of co-productions that have done pretty well. The Meg was an example of a cross-border China Hollywood co-production that did really good business in both countries, and I think The Meg 2 was also doing pretty well in both countries. So there's some hope there, I guess, that you can tap that audience if you're an American studio.
Finally, Ryan, a couple of newsletters back, you were writing a quote: "The movie business needs to get out of its own way." Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, yeah. So it's a little bit of what we were talking about earlier with mm-hmm. the problem of the strike and the deadlock and everything moving out. But what I was really focusing on was this idea that you have to have, that everything has to be IP, that everything has to be franchises, that you can't really, what needs to happen is that studios need to be comfortable with taking risks again. And because the only way that something like Barbie or Oppenheimer happens is that the studios find talented filmmakers who have a vision. And this obviously isn't always going to work, but when it does, you get out of the way, you let them cook and you let them make something great, and that's really the only way you get something really unique that's going to set off the industry like this. So again, sometimes Hollywood tends to take the wrong lessons these events.
Quite often, but hopefully this summer will, or at least these a few things that happen this summer will be, something to look.
This time will be different.
This time Hollywood will change.
That's right.
Women will be get a whole bunch of budgets and be.
Yes, absolutely. Give Jane Campion $100 million.
Yeah, big marketing budget and
big marketing push.
Let her go. Yeah, yeah.
A real theatrical release. That'd be great.
We'll see. Ryan, thank you so much for this. And can you tell the listeners where they can find Wide Shot and read your work?
Absolutely. Yeah, Wide Shot. I can't remember the URL, but you just Google Wide Shot LA Times. Find it on the LA Times website. It comes out every Tuesday, Tuesday morning, and it's completely free, whether you subscribe to the LA Times or not. But I encourage you all to subscribe to the LA Times. Don't just reload on us. But yeah.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much to Ryan Fonder. Make sure to check out The Wide Shot over at the LA Times. And thank you so much for listening to Pop Culture Confidential. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. See you next time.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.